rascals sell t-shirts and signing them. Dangerous and hateable. Find Lash and Bane here. They get the screwdriver and extension cord from the case. Beneath the seat was a stunt Bronx centerpiece. The grounding clip wire cord.
Finished with Grand National Brands, a.k.a. Grandental Bruins, from 1990, let's say 7 release, called 2000 release, called Communicating for Influence. The song we heard called Texas, Go to Texas. That preceded by a band we'll call Shambuka, or Chambuka, or Zambuka. Starts with an X. Julupuki, name of the CD, from which we heard Ivni Hit Me. Happy Refugees before that, from Return to Last Chance, Saloon, a song called This Is Cold. The Pastels, from Illumination, did On the Way. Judy Nylon, from Pal Judy, gave us Live in a Lift. Azusa Plain, from a 7-inch, a track Lou, Nico, Sterling, John, and Maureen. Sally Smith and her musicians, that's Sally Timms from the Mekons. Excerpts from Side A of her soundtrack to the film Hangahar. Andrew Peckler before that, from Sentimental Favors, the track Wichita Forever. We heard Kate Bush from a 7-inch, Experiment 4. Edgar Winter, Free Ride, from a 7-inch, played backwards. Great, great little bass sound there on the backwards, quite nice. Ruth before that, from the compilation Bip, French Synthwave, from 1979 to 1985. We heard Polaroid, Roman Photo. We opened that set with Cabaret Voltaire from the Best Of collection called The Original Sound of Sheffield, 78 to 82. Track called The Setup. That's everything we heard. My name's Scott. Thanks for listening tonight, and I'll see you next Monday at the same time. Right now, stay tuned for Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information coming right up. You're tuned to Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org.
What would you think if you knew that the advanced state of modern technology was all thanks to pornography? Oh my God, I don't want to read this.
When my friend Jim Colgan told me that he got his big break in journalism with a story he wrote for the Irish Times on porn and technology, I made him dig this 10-year-old gem up and read it out loud.
Well, it's so hard even to read, never mind. Not out loud. Thanks, porn, for helping me get a faster internet connection. Thanks for improving the quality of my online newsfeed.
So you launched your journalism career with this dreck.
Well, I did regular pieces for them after this. Like, I did regular technology pieces for this page. I remember how proud my mother was. And she'd, like, tell a lot of friends that I had something in the Irish Times, the feature. It's just that it happened to be about porn. I think, you know, all the editors got a chuckle. They're like, oh, look at this young person writing about porn and technology. And he, you know, he seems to know what he's talking about. And the fact that they didn't edit anything makes me think that they're just like, oh, these young folk, let's leave it up to them. But I thought this was a good story. Then.
Well, you did write it in 2001, so I guess that puts you ahead of the curve. But over the past decade, this piece has been written like a billion times, as we just discovered looking for it. So why is it you think that this piece, that this story, keeps getting written?
Well, it's got the elements of, you know, it's got a few elements of a story that to an editor is going to be attention grabbing. It's not just about porn, which, you know, so it gives you an excuse to talk about porn because it's like innovation and technology, and but it's got this sort of lurid aspect that people can sort of chuckle about, and so that's why it keeps coming up and up. In fact, I could probably pitch this to the Irish Times and they wouldn't even remember that I'd already done the story.
So here's what I'm looking for. Something that examines the connections between porn and technology, but in regards to society and culture, not gadgets or codecs. Have you ever come across something like that?
I don't think so. Have you?
Being a porn journalist is a job that I think I invented. It involves not only the lifestyles and the silliness and the anecdotal stories about visiting a porn set and the people that populate porn sets, but all the technology, the legal aspects, the First Amendment snafus that porn regularly finds itself in, and documenting them with respect to this industry and trying not to condescend to it or be too snarky, although you can't erase all the snarkiness.
Graham Ponante is definitely a snarky porn journalist, but he's also America's most beloved porn journalist. Well, that's at least what his website says. He told me that not only are journalists continually writing this lame story about porn and tech, but they are also continually getting it wrong.
The connections between the tech industry and the porn industry go way back, and porn takes undue credit for inventing the internet. It invented the internet in the same way that Al Gore did. But we can talk about porn deciding the war between VHS and beta. And that is a laurel that the porn industry rests on. But in the mid-90s, when the internet started taking off, porn was one of the things that got people to notice the internet on BBSs and, you know, proto chat boards. But these days, porn is responding to the internet more than it's driving technology. Like many other industries that are on the margins, porn is reactive rather than proactive.
Interesting. But that's definitely not what you normally hear. I mean, come on, isn't there a lot of innovation in the porn industry with, you know, at least new digital business models?
I see innovation as a result of desperation. And you could say that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. But I would say that people take to Facebook and Twitter not because they have other things to do, but instead because they have a lot of time on their hands. And then somewhere along the line, someone like you might whisper in their ear, monetize it. You know, because you're doing those things anyway. You're tweeting all day long, and you're sending candid pics of yourself from the bathroom in the airport when you're flying off to your dance gig. And someone whispers to you that you have been giving away for free what people used to pay for. And so it's reactive, getting back to your original question from about 6 hours ago. It's reactive in that a lot of these things that people would do for free, they realize only later, oh, I could charge for that. Even if it's just a little, I could charge for that.
Yeah.
And so what it does is it allows the oversharing that Facebook and Twitter engender anyway, and allows these people to get paid for things that they would do on their own. They would do it for free.
Okay, but on your site, there are a number of pieces that you've written about what seem to be kind of innovative ideas. Like, can you talk about fan stalking?
Yes, let's talk about Sabrina Deep and fan stalking. I think one thing that is lost when we talk about the commercialization of porn and sex saturating our culture and oversharing and, you know, the desensitization that is internet porn, we forget that some people like to have sex and that, you know, porn performers are kind of sexual superheroes and are actually evolutionarily pushing things forward where they are in this business because they actually like to have sex with people. And that I think in the business model that is porn is often forgotten, that a lot of people are doing it just for a job, but some people are doing it because they really like it. Mm-hmm. And so there's this multinational performer named Sabrina Deep who has started a site called fanstalker.net where she is actually going after her fans in the same way that they go after her, you know, in a consensual and healthy fashion.
Of course. I don't want to make it sound like I think Sabrina Deep's fan stalking is an unsafe idea. I think I'm just having a hard time actually articulating my question, because what I'm really interested in is understanding how the internet has changed our relationship with porn. You know, before the internet, society did a pretty good job of relegating porn to red light districts. It was marginal. But thanks to the internet, porn is not only everywhere, it's become a major part of culture.
I think what you're saying is correct, that because of the internet, people have access to sex in ways that they didn't before, where in the old days, all of 22 years ago, you would have to go to the, certain areas at the end of the subway line in various cities in order to get your fix of depravity. And now porn on the internet is pervasive and is something that bleeds through into mainstream entertainment to the point where you don't know if Lindsay Lohan was an actress before she was a porn inspiration or vice versa. You can't tell who's a porn star and who's not. Kim Kardashian, by the way, is, even though she made her name in porn, is not a very good porn star. and I'm glad she found paying employment in another industry. But I think people who did not have access to sex education have a lot more resources because porn is so pervasive on the internet. I'm not saying that you should learn how to love another human being or even, you know, physically handle another human being by what you notice in, you know, dirtpipemilkshakes.com. But I am saying that porn on the internet makes sex seem less scary, and it makes, by its pervasiveness, it makes sex seem a little bit more accessible, because when you're scared of something, you react to it in a frightened way. And as Master Yoda said, fear leads to suffering, and suffering leads to hatred, or somewhere in there.
I'm really proud of the Girlvert series because it's so weird. I don't even think I was trying to be sexy. I was just trying to be like this weird character, and it happened to be also like really disgusting sex, like the good disgusting, where you're like,
can I be in your wedding?
what the hell are you doing? I mean, I'm still kind of shocked that I was Performer of the Year.
Orianna Small is the alter ego of the hardcore porn star Ashley Blue. In her series Girlvert, she does everything imaginable, as well as things you never imagined were possible. Orianna Small's just authored a new book, also called Girlvert. But what really makes her porno memoir non-conventional is its resistance to a more traditional memoir formula. For me, Girlvert is not a redemption story, but rather a tale of self-discovery. And she didn't laugh at me when I told her this. Can I say that? Self-discovery?
Yeah.
It's not too highbrow?
No. No, not at all. I feel like it was, like, I wrote it with, like, a lot of love. Like, I really loved this time in my life. Even, like, I would go back and relive it the same exact way and go through all the, like, disgusting nights of coke sleep and, like, and crashing my car. Like, I would go back and do that. It was really, like, overall a fun time. Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely the sense I get from reading the book. But you kind of also seem like you're still gloating about how crazy and fun it was. I mean, the way you write about the scene when you're at the bank and you realize that you have some stuff on your face, you say you're proud of yourself.
Yeah. Well, I went and did a POV, which is point of view, porn, like a scene in a motel. And I mean, I was feeling just like, it just kept getting grosser and grosser. Like, I show up at the location, it's at a motel, and I felt like such a hooker. And I go in, and I'm just, every time the guy, like, you know, the male, there was one other guy, it was like, he went into the bathroom, and I just do tons of coke, like, as soon as he, like, turned his back. And then he came out, and we, you know, we did this, like, hardcore scene where he's just holding the camera. So I felt like I was just going there to hook. And and then he, like, you know, finishes, and I get my check. Like, instead of, it's, there's a big difference between prostitution and porn, because you get paid in a check for porn. You don't get paid in cash. There are some big differences, but that's one, like, that's one that comes to mind. So, like, I go to the bank, and it was, like, in Vons, and I go in to put my porn money into the bank, and then I realized I had, you know, crusted, like, cum all over my chin and my cheek, because I didn't wash myself. I didn't take a shower. Like, I'm just not, I never really was into that. Like, unless you're rolling around in the, you know, in, like, ashes or rocks or something, or there's, like, sand inside of you. Like, I would never shower after my scenes. I just didn't care. Like, I just try to wipe off and, like, leave.
So what was your reaction then when you realized that you probably should have taken a shower?
I wasn't disgusted when I saw the cum. I was secretly proud of myself. Because I'd walked in, like, and there are all these moms and, you know, everybody's grocery shopping. And yeah. I, you know, had some, like, nobody knew, but I knew. It was cool.
Well, I mean, I think if there was, like, one thing I would want to learn from you, it's that. It's, like, how to be more like that, like, not taking things so seriously. But after I finished the book, you know, it doesn't really seem that porn taught you that. It seems like that you were good at that from day one. And that's, in fact, maybe why you were able to take the whole porn industry by storm. No?
Yeah, I think not taking things seriously is in my DNA because of my mom. She's like, she got like, you know, she's kind of a delinquent. And so maybe I have that, like, I took that and made something good out of it by going into porn.
Let's talk about the story now. It seems like the whole, if we're going to blame somebody, it's going to be the Coachella Music Festival. Do you think a message needs to be sent about the price of their tickets?
Yes, definitely. That was even back in like 2002. Uh-huh. So, I mean, the ticket prices were high even then. And yeah, it was a huge reason why we kept doing porn, because we were like so fixated on going to Coachella that we were like, and we knew it was going to be like a, you know, like a weekend thing. So we needed all of our drugs. And so we have to keep doing porn.
You definitely make it clear that the decision to start doing porn is something both you and your boyfriend Tyler make together, and you both go on camera together. But for me, he still kind of is the villain of the story.
So funny that you think that he's the villain, because he's just kind of, you know, a loser. Like, when we first met, we were like in bed, and we just like had sex, and he's like, oh, I have to go to court tomorrow. And I was like, oh, really? Like, what kind of court? Like, traffic court? And he's like, no, turns out his charge was assault on an officer. But I stayed with him anyway. Like, he didn't end up going to jail, but it was like, he was that like criminal experience for me. Yeah. Like, he was the bad boy. But since then, I have never been attracted to that kind of person.
Yeah.
Because...
Yeah, no, I definitely get the sense from the book that you blame yourself for not saying no to him rather than him. But come on, your life gets way better when you ditch this guy. I mean, he literally has you working your ass off so he can spend your money.
It is so much better. I mean, it's so much
and
better.
And let's not forget, you do take him to court on national TV.
All rise. This court is now in session. The Honorable Judge Greg Mathis presiding.
Let's listen to a bit of your appearance on Judge Mathis.
Sir, what do you want to tell me about this so far?
We did have an open relationship the whole time we were together. Anything with going out and partying and things like that, we did together all the time, okay? And
even after you broke up? Mm-mm.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah?
No.
After you broke up
okay.
with him?
Well, that's fine. It doesn't
after
matter.
After you moved out?
It doesn't matter.
It does. It
no,
matters very much.
What is the question?
Your statement, the last statement you made. Are you hot now?
No.
Yeah, he needs to grow up. Like, even now, like, I have had nightmares where, you know, you wake up out of, like, a dead sleep and you're like, oh, my God, like, I'm feeling so bad for him. Mm. Like, and feeling so kind of guilty for writing about, like, our personal times together, because I feel like I don't want to hurt him any more than he's hurting himself.
Yeah,
but,
no way, no way. You paid for the hooker. You get to write about him. Sorry.
That the hooker in Vegas, that part is, that's like one of my favorite parts in the book. I just can't even believe that happened. That was the first time he got a hooker. Mm. I didn't write about when we went to Spain and he and I were walking, and it's like totally romantic. And he's like, you know what? I think I want to go to a brothel. And I'm like, why? And he's like, and we just finished like shooting some porn scenes in England, and we flew to Spain, and we're having this great time. And he's like, yeah, I really think I need that experience of going to a brothel. And then I started crying, and he's like, no, and he like calmed me down. Dropped me off at a hair salon and went to a brothel and came back. Like, it was...
Well,
it was funny.
Oh. The other, you know, the other main character, that doesn't get blamed, I guess, would be drugs. And, you know, there are so many drugs in this book. Sometimes it almost seems like you're reading, you know, Iggy Pop biography or autobiography. But you never really blame the drugs. I mean, obviously they contributed to bad decisions, but, you know, the way you write about it, it's almost like the same way drugs would contribute to bad decisions for a lawyer or a journalist. But, you know, at the same time, at the end of the story, you do get off of them, or you take them, you know, you take it down a couple of notches.
Yeah, I don't really, like, blame drugs, because, like, the drugs, I mean, they help me do things. They help me be more, like, bold, and they contributed to fun times, and then, you know, I took too many, and then, you know, kind of fucked up my life a little bit. But I had to stop doing drugs because it's just not acceptable for, you know, an older person, like, over a certain age, to be on drugs all the time. Like, I feel like it is okay when you're in your early 20s. Yeah. Like, I am not advocating drugs, but I feel like that's the time to do them.
Yeah, like, I feel the same way. That's why I kind of cut down as well. It's just, you know, eventually you kind of feel lucky that you didn't end up messed up.
Right, and you don't want to be like the old person doing drugs. That's so ugly and gross. Like, it's fun to do it when you're young, but then you don't want to be that gross, like, group of 50-year-olds doing E, you know, like, it's no.
But at the same time, I mean, yeah, and you know, this is, like, the hardest question, though. It's like, in a way, like, almost like people like yourself are lucky that you can have that ability to do that, and there are lots of people who kind of don't seem to be able to pull that off.
I am so lucky that, like, I was able to meet the people that I, like, meet my husband, and he really inspired me to be better. And I am really lucky, because I don't think, I look around at the people, like the people that are in that book that I've changed the names of so I'd protect them, because I don't want to be, like, saying, oh, so-and-so is a total, like, we were crackheads together and whatever. Like, so, but those people do exist, and some of them, I don't even know, who knows what happened to them. Yeah. I mean, their bottom, last time I heard, one of the girls in the book, her bottom teeth were turning brown and, like, ready to fall out from hitting the meth pipe on them so much. I mean, there are people who are not so lucky, and I feel like my story is okay. Like, go ahead and indulge yourself, like, all of the, you know, all the grossness in that book, because I did turn out okay, and that's why there's a happy ending to it. Yeah. There's the redemption. Like, no, my life is, like, my life's really lucky.
The memoir industry in America has seen a number of kind of pretty big train wrecks over the last few years. You know, so many of them have turned out to be fabricated. You know, like James Fry, obviously, is the biggest example. But as I was reading yours, it hit me that all of these crazy and improbable sounding things that you write about, they're all, like, verifiable and documented on video.
Yeah, they are.
But seriously, was there anything you wrote about that made you think, you know, oh man, no one is going to believe this?
Let me think. I don't know. I mean, so I guess, like, the stuff in the movies, that was crazy, but I got really, like, used to it.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know, maybe when I, when I was out in the woods and we were shooting a movie called White Trash Whore, and I was getting, getting nailed on a broken down washer, and then some kind of wasp came over and stung me in the inside of my thigh. Like, that's kind of crazy. Like, that's very improbable, but that did happen, and it is on film.
And I guess that's a story we can actually put on the radio.
I see pornography as folk art, and the fact that now it spreads on the internet without any money marketing and all this, but like just people want to show what they are doing. It has its own importance in art. Closest case I can see is the case of comics books or cartoon. It has been used in pop art or in great high art in the 60s. Lichtenstein used it and many other artists. It has been used as a resource for art. It has been used as a source of inspiration, of imitation. But the genre itself, the comic books or the cartoons, remained what it is. I really see a continuation in terms of the like importance in folk art and pop culture from comic books to porn today. The same like global interest, people looking after this, trying to be very inventive on this, trying to share images and all this. It's, for me, it's like there is a kind of continuity. So maybe something even worse will come after porn, and porn will be transformed something, which will be quite acceptable.
Gruen Ogier is a philosopher who mostly writes about ethics, but he's also written about pornography. And his comparison of porn and comic books seemed to be quite astute, because back in the day, comic books, like porn, was subjected to serious censorship. And today, many cartoonists are still forced to defend their craft as having either literary or artistic merit. But what Gruen Ogier wants us to understand is that by forcing porn to have artistic merit in order to escape censorship or gain acceptance, we make it impossible for porn to come into its own.
You know, like, if you think about censorship, we accept that sexual representation can be controlled in case it's not artistic enough, and we suppose that it's something which is not like unfair to control pornography if its only aim is to arouse us sexually. It should have something else, some kind of refined feeling that it could provoke in order to escape all this control. So the place of pornography is like it's something which is supposed to be non-art, and it's a definition feature of pornography that it is not art. If it is art, it's not pornography. If it's pornography, it's not art. But no, porn asks us to think a little more deeper, because it wouldn't happen that easily. You have like comedy tries to make you laugh, and you have melodrama tries to make you cry, and horror movie tries to make you fear, and then you have this porn just tries to arouse you sexually, and it's difficult for me to understand why this should be forbidden. It is strange to ask for porn something that we don't ask for any other form of art. For example, we are not asking from the memories of Céline Dion that they have artistic value. It won't be, for example, it won't be take away from the shelves in bookshops because it's not artistic enough. We are not asking this for most of the book we can see at Barnes & Noble, for example. And we wouldn't say, for example, that a comedy doesn't make us feel sophisticated feelings, but just make us laugh. So we should just censor it, we should forbid it. But for pornography, we are using these standards.
But don't you think that the argument can be made that porn already is art and is something that can speak to us about weighty subjects like the human condition?
My point was more that suppose it doesn't. Is it a reason to control it, to forbid it, and to put it down as it is done normally? This was more my point. I think that when we speak about porn and art, or porn and human conditions, is the two questions you have raised, I would have the same claim that keep porn as it is. Don't try to make it more artistic, or don't try to make it more human. It's human and artistic as it is.
2005, the internet had already claimed most porn consumers.
In 2005, Colleen Kane took an editor job at Playgirl magazine. And as much as she wanted to make the magazine great, she knew it was too late. Most porn magazine readers had already discovered the magic porn box, also known as the computer. Sure, there were a few people still buying the magazine, but they were the dumb ones.
Not the most technologically savvy gang of people, and they were kind of like the dregs.
The magazine shut down in 2007, and Colleen was out of a job, but she can still vividly recall some of her correspondence from the final days of IRL porn.
Let me find one here. Okay, we have, here's a letter from a young lady. It came on pink notebook paper and had like loopy little girl style handwriting. It goes like, "Dear, Naked Man magazine, I am an 18-year-old girl who needs your help. 3 days ago, I called it quits with my boyfriend because he wouldn't shave his boner. I asked him 3 different times to shave it all bald. We always ended up with a fight. I picked up my first issue of Playgirl in frustration and saw 2 guys I liked that are shaved. One is Chase Wright, but he doesn't have a boner. 2 is Hot Tommy Gunn. He's nice and shaved. I like his boner, but I wish his shaved boner would stand up straight in the air without the help of his hand. I'm an 18-year-old girl who needs these things, you know. What back issue do you have that have guys shaved and shows his boner? Could you write me back and let me know?"
Huh.
So, yeah, we got this and laughed and sort of also wanted to cry because it's like you could just write back and tell her, "Dear so-and-so, there is something called the internet."
If you I'm looking right now. I'm trying to go to see if shavedboner.com, what happens? And I type it in, and I've got, there it is.
Yeah, it's, bam, it's probably an entire...
Oh, my. You can, of course, still get IRL porn. You just have to go to the porn store to get it. The porn store is still the industry's ultimate middleman. And while the porn shop business is suffering in ways similar to the record store or the DVD shop, many of them are still thriving. My old friend Libby Lynn works in a porn shop in Durham, North Carolina. She likes to refer to it as the Porn Shack. And so I called her up to find out how the Porn Shack remains relevant in the digital age.
It's a combination of toy sales and a little bit from the booth, and then video sales. We've had regulars that have been shopping here for 12-something years.
And do you have relationships with your regulars?
Yes. In fact, I've had a couple of them commission me for paintings. A lot of them have come to my art show. They know my boyfriend. They know my lover. They know my family.
What, they're not the same person?
No, they're not. No, I'm not. I don't do the monogamy thing. Too challenging, too hard. There's the door.
What does that mean?
This is usually like the time when the drunk college students come in.
And what are they buying?
They usually buy, we mostly get, the place where I went to school is called NCCU Central, is its nickname. Those students mostly buy like condoms, lubricants, vibrators, and magic sex pills, for lack of a better term.
Uh-huh.
And then the Duke students usually buy like handcuffs and miniature blow-up transsexual or transgender dolls and or sheep.
Huh.
There's a lot of people here who won't buy things online. Our second best customer is a millionaire who's in like some sort of brokerage something. He's an old southern white man, and I call him Massa Bobby. because he just strikes me as the kind of guy who would be really good at running a plantation. But he buys an ungodly amount of porn, and he must have like some kind of fault, because he must spend $15,000 a year here on DVD. And when I asked him, you know, like, Bobby, just out of curiosity, like, why don't you go online? You know, like, there's so many options, and the content is so much more creative, and there's all the Japanese stuff, you know, that's super weird and cool. And he just says, nah, I don't mess with that stuff. Nah. Too dangerous, too sketchy. So that's a lot of it. And also, like, I think people don't have computers and still have DVD players, or they don't know how to find porn.
Yeah, man, your door is just banging.
Your buzzer is
going off the hook. Business is booming.
That's a good sign. I'm pretty sure it's the drunk people.
And do you have to worry about them? I mean, do they ever get out of line?
One guy threatened to kill me, but we're friends now. There's a lot of, like, rapey guys who come in here, and I'm not the youngest female who works here, so that helps. And also, men don't scare me at all. In fact, I think I kind of scare them pretty bad.
So, Libby, you were one of my most promising friends from my youth. How did you end up working at the porn shack?
Because they were the only people that would possibly hire me.
Oh, man. So, I have something to tell you. I also once worked at a porn store when I was in college in Montana. I worked at Miss Kitty's.
That is not surprising at all.
This was a really strange job. So I worked around the corner at this tobacco magazine store. And I always knew that the people that worked at the porn shop got paid a lot more.
Yeah.
And one day, and you know, the owner would always come in to buy cigarettes in the morning. And one day he said, hey, do you want to work at the shop? Because, you know, Tommy's got to go away for a while. Or, you know, I
got
to get
recruited.
I got recruited.
What is it about you that inspired him to recruit you?
Well, it's kind of a sham. Really, it turns out that Tommy had to go to rehab for his meth addiction, so they were kind of really faking me out. They didn't want to hire someone else, so they were just kind of like, they figured they'd fill me in and then get rid of me when he got out of rehab, which is what they did.
Oh, no.
So I got used. I got totally used by the porn shop.
And you were robbed of the real... I mean, it takes at least 2 years to get the full experience of working adult retail.
Well, trust me, I have plenty of memories from my one summer in the business. Like my favorite customer, this one guy who walked up to the counter one night and he was very excited and he slammed his fist on the table and said, son, I'm gonna take you home and you in the ass. And I'm like, well, sir, that's not gonna happen, but can I interest you in a pocket vagina? We have white ones and black ones.
You know, the pocket pussy industry has really blossomed.
Really?
I swear, like, the one area that has really sort of, like, added new things, like, some of which make sense and some of which don't make any sense at all, are the male masturbators and, like, sex toys for men.
Yeah, no, this guy bought them both.
Good.
So, describe for me the layout of your porn shack.
The sales floor is where we sell the toys and the lingeries and the lubes and the whips and the chains and the Jennings gags and the Wartenberg wheels and the DVDs. And then across from that, there's a hallway, and then you have your jerk-off booth. And that's where people go to jerk off and watch porno. And
do you have to clean that up?
Not generally. Sometimes when people return discs, they've made poor choices.
Well, at Miss Kitty's, there were 4 booths, and I was supposed to clean those.
Did you have live shows, or was it videos?
No, it was videos, but I was supposed to take care of those, too, and I was like, hell no. So I just, you know, and I only worked there a few months, so I never do that. That may have contributed to why I didn't get to stay, but... who would even go into one of those today when you have the internet?
Well, just based on, like, my observations and picking the brains of the people who have worked here for a long time, It's mostly older Southern, and I can only, we're in the South, so clearly there, you know, the Southern thing comes into play. Older Southern men, and I think that's how they grew up sexualizing themselves, was to go to peep show, stag movie machines that play porn. Some people, I think, just like to jerk off in public, and with men, it's almost like if you watch their behavior, it's like they're going to the bathroom. You know, it's like they've got build up and they need to release, and they come in and
they just go straight for the booth.
Yes, the boothies.
You call them the boothies.
I call them the boothies. I do.
You know, porn makes me feel really old. Mostly, you know, not only remembering the back in the day, my porn shack days, but just back when I was a kid, you know, when I'd be like excited about the Sears catalog and I'd be like, you know, grabbing the bra section in the bathroom.
That really did it for you.
Yeah.
You know, the first porn I ever saw, I was probably, oh gosh, like 8. And it was called Cheerleaders in 3D. And I didn't know how to masturbate. I actually didn't have an orgasm until I was 19.
Uh-huh.
But I would masturbate a lot as a child. I was a very sexual child. And I got caught by my older brother watching Cheerleaders in 3D with the 3D glasses on, and me, like, doing what I thought was masturbating, which was grabbing the crotch of my jeans and smacking it really hard.
Huh.
Your internal pipe system is much easier than ours. I've often wished for both a penis and a vagina, so on those days when I really don't feel like, you know, spending 5 hours with Joey or Johnny or whomever, I could just, you know, give it a little tug and be done with it.
In the spring of 2008, an aggressive advertising campaign appeared in the Broadway Lafayette subway station in Lower Manhattan. Its long upper corridor, okay, there's some poetic writing. Like an
Gemma
MC
Seif is the book editor at Harper's Magazine and the author of Photo Ops, an essay about porn and war in the latest issue of N Plus One. Her epic story begins in the subway with a splashy ad campaign for Belvedere Vodka.
The ads showed fashionable people partaking of New York City nightlife, cuddling in a lounge banquette, huddling under a piano during an indoor rainstorm, eating a club sandwich with grim sophistication. The indie actor Vincent Gallo, hung with the pyramidal pendant of the Masons, offered his denim-clad crotch to a woman in need. She uses his belt buckle as a compact mirror, applying to parted lips the pink protuberant of a lipstick. There was this kind of, I don't know what the word I'm looking, like this meta quality to the campaign that I found fascinating. The people in the ads were the people they expected to be walking by the ads. But what really disturbed me the most was, like, the attention that I had paid these images, and then they got taken down, and then they came back, and the meta quality had become that much more, I don't know, unignorable, in the sense that, like, now the photographer was, like, front and center. It says in this large font above the picture, like a big credit, photographed by Terry Richardson. And so I just began to feel crazy, and, like, I was trapped in some kind of weird vortex where I couldn't escape Terry Richardson.
Terry Richardson, the photographer of the Belvedere Vodka campaign, is one of the most successful photographers working today. He's both a star in the fashion world and the art world, but he's also a celebrity in his own right. On his blog, Terry's World, you can see pictures of himself cavorting with Barack Obama and Lady Gaga.
I think what differentiates Terry from other fashion-forward photographers is that he self-implicates, and the self-implication is in often including himself in his pictures. He's a pretty regular-looking guy in some ways, although I would say his charisma comes through in his pictures, his sexual charisma does. But, like, it's a fantasy. It's a very sophisticated urban male fantasy, which is he himself is participating in these glorious sexual acts. You know, pornography for smart people. There are iconic things Terry likes to do when he puts himself in his photos. One is he likes to hold up his little Yashica. The other is that he gives you a big smile, a big, goofy, happy smile. It's pretty sincere. He's having a good time. Another thing he likes to do is give the thumbs up. So then I realized something about, like, his face looks familiar. The posture with the thumbs up and the camera in the picture was deranging me. It was deranging me for probably a few weeks. And then when I figured it out, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. He looks like Charles Grainer's twin.
Now, maybe you've never seen a photo of Terry Richardson giving you the thumbs up, but it's most likely you have seen a picture of Charles Grainer doing just that. You see, Charles Grainer was one of the guards at Abu Ghraib.
He's the guy who's giving the thumbs up. And he's the guy who looks like he's having a really fun time. He's also the guy who, when he isn't taking the picture, is often photographed with a camera in his hand. He was called in the news media the ringleader of the abuse. And I think that that might be right. Maybe it's like the architect. He's kind of like setting up these scenarios to photograph. You get that feeling when you read the documents. And this is Charles Grainer speaking to his army interrogator. The females were out. All the females basically were allowed to roam the little area that they had. Redacted and Redacted were flirting with them. And this happened toward the end of the night. Sergeant Redacted, she had wanted to give Sergeant Redacted a photograph, I guess, and I had taken them. And then I took the one, and then she called me back for another one. She pulled her top off. The way I remember it, she had pulled me over. She wanted to get a picture, and we had been taking pictures all night long. I had left, and she motioned me back, and she pulled her top up, took the picture. Of her own volition, notes Grainer, befitting the party vibe. These girls that Grainer is talking about are prostitutes that they've arrested. Why Americans are arresting prostitutes is perplexing, but anyway. Quote, when they got me naked, one detainee told the Physicians for Human Rights, they used to bring all the female soldiers to look at me and say, hello, Imam. As at a disco, there were strobe lights and a powerful amp. The music so loud that detainee Kamal bled from his ears and heard the music after it was turned off. The party began, said another detainee, when they started to put the muzzle of the rifle and the wood from the broom into my anus. They entered my privates from behind, and there was blood all over my feet. The party vibe that the army would like to disavow and would like to pretend is Grainer, this, like, you know, sadist weirdo, just having fun with prisoners, and America doesn't do that over there, can be traced back to this psychiatrist named Ewan Cameron.
Ewan Cameron is the third man of Gemma Seif's piece, and he's one of the OGs of secret government mind control and behavior modification research, best known for his work on the CIA's LSD-fueled MK-Ultra project.
The research of this psychiatrist, Ewan Cameron, contributed toward the earliest CIA torture manuals, and these are the things that we're seeing in black sites today. The army language I did find very interesting. Change of scenery down, fear up harsh, pride and ego down, futility. So Grainer, when he's setting up people in a stack, is probably in his head thinking, I'm following orders in that I'm doing pride and ego down because this is humiliating to stack naked men. And change of scenery. Well, let's move them into this basement where we throw a Nerf ball over them. And so, like, the party vibe is part of this thing that we've had since the Cold War. These are techniques that America has been working on for a long time. So I was doing a lot of research about these, what happened at Abu Ghraib, and then I just could not believe that the guy who like, the architect of the campaign that had besotted me for so many months was also named Ewan Cameron. And he's also Scottish, and he's not a psychiatrist. He's, you know, he's an ad man, and he's good at his job. But I just could not believe he had the same name, spelled the same way. So I called him up, and I talked to him about whether he thought the campaign was channeling, like, subconscious guilt about the Iraq War, thoughts about the Iraq War, imagery from the Iraq War, and he said, no, this is just about sex.
So we have two doublings. Both Terry Richardson and Charles Grainer stare into the camera and give us the thumbs up. And we have two Ewan Camerons, One, a behind-the-scenes guy for torture and humiliation, and the other, an ad man. But for Gemma Seif, these doublings are not mere coincidences.
I guess I found the doubling just much deeper, because then I think if you think about, like, who hired Terry Richardson and what he thought would speak to the people of New York, it's sex and, like, kind of roughed up but really hip and glamorous nightlife. And if you think about, you know, the architecture of the techniques they're using in these prisons, it's you and Cameron, and I don't know, it just seems to me like impossible to ignore how connected these things really are. If you put play in a war or prison circumstance, you get Abu Ghraib. If you put play and sex in fashion, you get Terry Richardson. This is Terry Richardson speaking about his work. He says, I know most people have collections of this kind of material, even in the fashion industry. You look at the images from Iraq with that 20-year-old girl making prisoners masturbate for the camera. It comes from porn. I think it will become the norm for people to have cameras in their homes documenting their sexual activity. It's there. Why not bring it out into a mainstream context? This episode of Too Much Information is called Porn. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen and Laura Mayer. It featured Jim Colgan, Graham Panante, Oriana Small, Ruen Ogien, Colleen Kane, Libby Lynn, and Gemma Seif. Special thanks to Therese Mahler, Dave Naz, Tyson Cornell, and The Village Lay. There's even more information on the TMI show page, links, photos, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. All that at WFMU.org.
Join us again at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show.
Angst. Nardwuar. 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 Nardwuar.
Hi, this is Robert Plant bringing you Manic Nirvana, as only I can, on the radio. Take two and swallow hard. Don't use your teeth.
Exercise 2, for supple feet. Standing, hands on hips. Rise high on your toes, heels up, then down. Rock back on your heels, toes up, then down. Start, on your toes, down. On your heels, down. Heels up, down. Toes up, down, on your toes, down, on your heels, down, on your toes, down, on your heels, down, high on your toes, down, high on your heels, down, on your toes, down, on heels, down. down. Stop, breathe deeply, and listen.
And you're listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwuar the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today on the Nardwuar the Human Serviette Radio Show, an interview with the rockabilly Rasputin, Johnny Legend, from Alameda, California. Right now, gonna begin with a Johnny Legend-endorsed tune, Sebastian Cabot, with Like a Rolling Stone, on the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show, on coming up, an interview with Johnny Legend, WFMU.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine. You threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say, beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they're all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now, you don't talk so loud. Now, you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging for your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown. Like a rolling stone. Now, we've gone to the finest school, all right, Miss Lonely. But you know you only used to get juiced in it. And nobody ever taught you how to live on the street, and now you gotta get used to it. You said you'd never compromise with the mystery tramp. But now you realize he ain't selling any alibis as you stare into the vacuum of his eyes and ask him, do you want to make a deal? How's it feel? How does it feel to be without a home, like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone? You never turned round to see the frowns on the jugglers and the clowns when they all came down and did tricks for you. Never understood that it ain't no good. You should let other people get your kicks for you. You used to ride on the chrome horse with your diplomat who carried on his shoulder a Siamese cat. Ain't it hard when you discover that he really wasn't where it's at after he took from you everything he could steal? How does it feel? Huh? How does it feel to be without a home, like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone? Princess on the steeple and all the pretty people drinking, thinking they've all got it made, exchanging all kinds of precious gifts and things. But you better lift your diamond ring. You better pawn it, babe. You used to be so amused at Napoleon and his rags and the language that he used. Well, go to him now. He calls you. You can't refuse. When you've got nothing to lose. Oh, you're invisible now. You got no secrets to conceal. How's it feel, huh? How's it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown. Like a rolling stone.
And do we have a caller on the line? Hello, are you there, caller?
I hope I'm not a caller. I'm a superstar.
Who? Who are...
Who? I'm not a caller. I'm Johnny Legend. I'm supposed to be a star. Just because I happen to be on the phone doesn't mean I'm a caller.
Who are you?
Who am I?
Yes, please explain, Johnny Legend. Who are you?
If you need an explanation, you're already too late.
Well, to me,
I'm the most famous person you never heard of. I'm the man who started it all, and I'm getting ready to just about end it.
To me, you are the guy that put words to Pipeline. I mean, that's all that you got to say. You put words to the song Pipeline.
Absolutely, and that still hasn't really kind of gotten through to the general public. I'm hoping to get that through, you know, in the next year or so. I'm performing it live again. I performed it in New Orleans at Ponderosa Stomp. I'm performing it with my new band, and I have a recording, a correct recording of my vocal version of Pipeline that still has not come out yet. There was a very mediocre pedestrian version that came out in the early 90s where we only had an hour or so. We didn't really get it down to, you know, the magnitude of how brilliant it is. I even met the Shantays, the gentleman who recorded the original Pipeline backstage at the Greek one night and told them about it, and they just said, have at it, man, great.
Well, we're actually going to play...
So that was kind of music to my heart. That's all I've ever done, actually.
We're going to play that version, Johnny Legend.
I'm like this lounge singer from the early 60s who had an epiphany one night, and he wrote words to Pipeline. He thought he was going to be set for life, and here it is 40, 50 years later, and he's still doing it in lounges, and that's all it's ever come to.
Well, also, Johnny Legend, I'm just going to say, we're going to end the Nerdware to Human Serviette Radio Show. I know we've just begun, but I'm going to say we're going to end the Nerdware to Human Serviette Radio Show when we're finished with the interview and we're spared to Johnny Legend. We're going to end actually with that version of Pipeline that you referred to. Johnny Legend, Pipeline vocal, backed with Mexican Love on the Hillsdale record label from Daly City, California, Johnny Bartlett.
Bartlett lives a few miles from me now because I'm up in Northern California, up here in Alameda, right next to Oakland and what's that other one? Berkeley, like my famous.